The views and opinions of this podcast are solely those of the creators and do not reflect any streaming service or platform. This podcast contains strong language and contrarian viewpoints that may be objectional to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Three Geeks in a Microphone Podcast. I'm Dean.
I'm Art.
I'm Russ.
And today we have two very special guests with us. Our good friend, Michael French, host of Retro Blasting. Michael, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And our other damn good friend, Mr. Tom Burgess from I Grew Up Star Wars.
Now, when you say special, do you mean, you know, special? Special ed?
Both.
Because if that's the case, you've come to the right place.
Today, our topic is Star Wars. From not just the movies, the entire franchise. We're going from top to bottom on this one.
Uh-oh. Oh, God. A while.
So I figure that the first question I want to put to you guys is this. What does Star Wars mean to you?
Michael, let me rephrase that. What did Star Wars mean to you?
Tom, I want you to field that first because you were first out of the gate on this temporarily, and you were there. I was born 1 year, 2 months, and 2 days after the release of the first film. So I defer to you for the first answer, sir.
Well, when I was 7 years old, almost eight, we went to watch Star Wars at the theater in my little town of Lewiston, Idaho, which was incredibly amazing. I'd never been to a theater before. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was at the theater. I watched a matinee one time for Clarence the Cross-Eyed Lion, that Walt Disney film. And this was my second movie I'd ever watched. And this was the most amazing, most incredible thing I'd ever seen. And lines were out the door around the block for probably a year after that, because Star Wars was in the theater, of course, everywhere for a very long time. And it was literally life-changing. I mean, my life was still pretty young, but everything out of that, every memory that I can think of is strangely associated with Star Wars. Now, when I say Star Wars, I mean at least the classic trilogy, but mostly the first film. Everything started at Star Wars. Everything before that was really kind of a jumble of Planet of the Apes and Young Frankenstein.
Wow. Okay, so I guess let's go around the room. Michael?
Yeah, my story is very similar to Tom just a few years later, because I was born in 78 and summer of 78. My earliest memories are a jumble of Superman, Spider-Man, Robin Hood, Zorro, and Dukes of Hazzard. And then from there, Star Wars appeared in my life in 1982. I was at the home of my parents' friends. They were playing cards, and this guy was like, one of those dudes in the 80s that had like the state-of-the-art home theater at the time with a big sectional couch and the Sony front projection television with that unit that sat on the floor that projected the image onto the screen with those, you know, green, red,
three colors. Yep. Belt.
Yeah. And he had this full, no commercials, because obviously it'd never been broadcast on TV yet, but it was making the rounds on early cable. He had a tape of Star Wars off of a cable station. So he said, have you ever seen this movie called Star Wars? And I was like, no. And I was like 4 years old, but I'll never forget that moment, because he put me down on this big plush, you know, very 80s couch. And then he and his wife and my parents went into their very 80s breakfast room to play cards right behind me. Very, you know, and I sat in this, you know, cool couch watching this movie on what felt like the biggest TV I'd ever seen at the time. Like, it really was for the 80s. That was a big television. And so, you know, to answer the question, kind of like Tom joked a second ago, what did Star Wars mean to you? What was Star Wars? it was encountering something that had limitless possibilities. It was a story with all kinds of heroes, and it really opened up your imagination in a way that it was accessible to a young child, where you were going to be a few years before you were able to plug into Star Trek as a kid. Like, Star Trek is an intelligent show. Not that Star Wars is stupid, but Star Wars is a fairy tale. And so as a kid, the gateway for understanding it, the bar for understanding it as a child, is much lower, because it's folklore and mythology redistilled into a science fiction space fantasy kind of thing. I love Star Trek, but I didn't get it until four or five years later, I guess, when I really started to understand it. So Star Wars was this this story that made me realize, oh, well, not everything has to be set on Earth, and not everything has to involve Earth. You know, like, Superman's fantastic, but he's on Earth. And I love the Dukes of Hazzard, but they're just two normal guys in a car on Earth. And, you know, Zorro and Robin Hood, they're two guys in Earth of the past. And this story was like, we're not even touching any of that. We're going somewhere totally different. You know, so you started as a child to, like, have your whole imagination open up, like, when you got the toys and everything. And it was, you know, I don't know how to describe it beyond that. It was something that really, to cop a phrase from the movie itself, it helped me take my first steps into a larger world of storytelling and imagination. And I think that's why it's left an imprint on so many people.
Right, because it's such a universal type story. Mm-hmm. What is it? I remember in college we were discussing it. There was a book written about it. Myth. Help me out here, guys.
Joseph Campbell's Heroes. Thank you. That's it.
Yep. And when I saw that, that's what kind of linked it for me. I saw that in college, and it just clicked. I'm like, oh my God, I'm watching a really old tale through modern eyes.
Yep.
So, Art, first memories of Star Wars?
Oh, it was probably, I like Michael, I was born in 78. I was born in February. So I probably didn't see it till 1980. I think it was about the time I remember seeing it, because we had just gotten HBO. And it was on HBO. And HBO back then was still pretty new. The whole concept of cable television was still pretty new. And I think that was like the first movie we watched on HBO was the original Star Wars. So, and I was absolutely blown away by it. The you know, the technology, the Millennium Falcon. I really didn't care about Luke. Harrison Ford and the Falcon were like it for me. And then all of the buttons and stuff on the ship, the different lights, there was a lot of blues and reds, and you don't see that in everyday life or our technology. It was just completely futuristic in a sense. But I was already at the same time watching like the original Star Trek. It was on Saturday nights and in reruns, and I was obsessed with it too, in the colors and all the different things going on, the laser beams or the phasers. And I couldn't wait to get my hands on real technology. Boy, was I let down on a submarine.
Russ?
Well, I was 6 months old when the original Star Wars aired.
Oh, enough. My God. You guys are all little babies. I'm talking to a bunch of little babies.
So I had older siblings. My brother was 15 years older. My sisters are 12 and 7 years older. So all this talk of Star Wars, I knew the story before I saw the movies. It's kind of a mixed feeling, because I knew Darth Vader was Luke's father without ever seeing the movies. My first memories of Star Wars, and Tom will probably appreciate this, I was a toddler. My brother and sister were watching the holiday special on TV at our old home. And I was so excited. Oh, I could finally see this mythical thing of Star Wars. I don't remember anything except Chewbacca's son, and it scared the shit out of me. So I had like maybe a minute worth of seeing Lumpy before they took me into the other room and had me go to bed. But then after that, my next, I was able, my aunt gave me a Star Wars Empire Strikes Back pop-up book. So it would have been about 1980, 81 when this happened. So that book became like this way into seeing the Star Wars world, until I finally, my mom took me to the theater to see Return of the Jedi in 83. So I actually saw the movies in reverse, Jedi, then Empire, then Star Wars much later on, because I already knew the whole story. How it affected me, it's almost like it's just been such a part of my entire life. I knew Darth Vader like I did Santa Claus. It just was there. It's always been there. The story. So I've always wondered, and I've asked some of my older friends, what was it like to live in a world without Star Wars? And usually they're like, whatever. And it's disappointing, because I'm like, I'm wanting to see this. I want to hear the stories of how it changed lives. And most of them are just old rednecks. And they're like, I go drive my pickup truck, so
the thing is, Russ, it did. I mean, when I was a kid, I was watching, the Shaggy DA and the Bad News Bears before Star Wars. And there was nothing like Star Wars before Star Wars. You know what I mean? I mean, there was Planet of the Apes, and there was what else? There was Logan's Run and that kind of thing. But that just slightly, ever so slightly scratched the surface. I mean, when people saw this, it was just no one had ever seen this before. And you can't really fault folks that are younger, because they've grown up with Star Wars-esque entertainment. But before, there was King Kong, and that was state of the art. That was the 76 version of King Kong, which was awesome. But I mean, nothing, there was nothing like it before. It was a phenomenon.
Yeah, see, that's one of the things I would, as a kid, Buck Rogers in the 25th century, that was my go-to show, to get a little bit of sci-fi.
I've heard of that show.
To your point, Tom, that is one benefit that I had in my early childhood, like I said, was that my mom had instantly allowed me to watch all these classic movies and stuff that were still, they were awesome and I loved them, but they were very like all earthbound. They were all, so my little bubble there from, 79, 80 through 1982, there was nothing like Star Wars in my life. There was nothing like, none of the cartoons, they were all superhero cartoons like Super Friends or Spider-Man. And, so Star Wars, even though it had been around, a few years, I had no awareness of it whatsoever, like none. So when it hit me, when I sat down in front of it, that day, it hit me like a sack of bricks. Like it was just like, wham. And so in that sense, it was a strange simulation, like a micro simulation of what it must have been like in 77 for it to land on our entire culture.
Sure. I mean, I was born in 76. So I was a little over a year old when the originals came out. I'm guessing I probably saw Star Wars for the first time, as I've said many times on the show, at my aunt's house. My aunt had a beta player and she had it on beta. And I would, every weekend, I would watch it, the original Star Wars, at least once. In fact, I wore the tape out. I watched it so much. It's like Michael said, the first time I saw it, my jaw was on the ground. When you see the door explode and the first time you see Vader for the first time, it's like, who is this guy? What's his story? Why is he in this iron lung? It just blew me away. I've loved it ever since. Well, right up until Disney, but we'll get into that. Like a lot like Russ, my mom took me to see Jedi in 83. I will always remember the first time seeing that Star Wars splash up on the screen with the music in a theater is something I will never, ever forget. Same thing when we saw The Phantom Menace at midnight. I went to an opening show and it was crazy. Everyone was in costume and it was the craziest thing I think I've ever done. It was dead silence when the lights went down. And as soon as those opening notes hit, the crowd erupted. And it's unlike anything I've ever experienced before.
Phantom Menace was the best time I've ever had in a movie theater before the movie started.
Yeah. And I've seen
it. And then once the movie started, it was like eating a shotgun blast. Like it was.
Phantom Menace was the only movie that I really, really tried to like, but failed.
Yeah, I tried 14.
I tried. Times. I really did. And I just couldn't do it.
Yeah, I have all 14 ticket stubs that summer trying to like it. I was that desperate to figure out what I was missing.
And me too. Yeah, that's about that's how many times I watched it and I just still couldn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Still couldn't
reach,
do it.
Tom. We reach.
So. Well, you know, you put glitter on a piece of shit, it's still a piece of shit.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I can see that because when I walked out of there seeing it for the first time, well, first I was kind of in shock. I didn't know what I had just seen. All I knew is I had saw an original brand new Star Wars movie in a theater. On the second and third viewings is when I went, this isn't as good as I was expecting. Maybe it was more hype than anything else. Did now, Art, Russ, do you guys see the, any of them in the theater?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've seen all the movies in the theater. Even the horrible Disney ones. Yeah, with Phantom Menace, I remember I didn't go to the midnight showing. I just had this gut feeling. It's like, I'm not staying up that late. The Star Wars fan in me was like, I want to see it. But I'm not going to go camp out in front of a theater. Luckily, being in a small town, later that opening weekend, I got tickets. I went to see it, and I didn't hate it. I didn't like it. It just felt like one of those bad movies that you watch on a Sunday afternoon, you know, when you're sitting at home with a flu and you're too lazy to change the channel. That's what it felt like. It's like I was entertained to see where it was going from point A to point B, but I didn't want to watch it again. In fact, I think I did see it in the theater twice. And then someone gave it to me on VHS as a gift. And I don't even own the DVD. I'm just like, whatever. The best part is watching, you know, the lightsaber duel at the end. Even that was kind of weak because you kind of don't care about the characters.
You mean that overly choreographed lightsaber duel at the end?
Yeah, that was kind of fun. You know, you add a little disco lights and some BG music and you're good to go.
Here we go. And 1, 2, 3, slash, 1, 2, 3, turn, 1, 2, 3.
You almost see Bob Fosse off, you know, camera left choreographing that. Yeah.
Raise your sabers high.
Yeah.
Art, what about you, dude?
I actually, before the movie came out, and I had an impressive book collection. I had like all of the books, every Star Trek or Star Wars and Star Trek book ever released up to that time. And I actually had gone and bought the book before the movie came out. I wasn't really impressed. I didn't bother to go see it.
Wow. I'm kind of surprised. So as far as The Phantom Menace goes, my buddy Rick and I, we actually sat in line for 23 hours for tickets. I'm one of these morons that camped outside for tickets. In fact, at the time, I actually got into trouble at work because I had called into work and we were sitting outside and I wasn't expecting a news crew to come up and film the crowd.
Yeah, you're done.
Yeah. Yeah. I had bought the maximum amount of tickets they were allowed, which I think was 6. So I had an extra pair. And the next day I go into work and my boss hauls me into his office and he says, where were you yesterday? I'm like, oh, I was sick. He's like, well, really, why did I see you on the 7 o'clock news? I'm like, oops. And then writes me up for it and then has the audacity to ask me if I have extra tickets. So I tell him, I'm like, yeah, I got an extra pair. They're $500 a piece. How many you want?
Wow. What'd he say?
He declined. But to be honest, that you just brought up a memory for that. That night when we actually went to see it, we were waiting around to go in, and there was this guy and his kid. His kid had to be maybe five, I'm guessing. And he kept walking around asking people, you know, do you have extra tickets? People were asking him for ridiculous prices, you know, $100, $200. The kid's like, you know, he just had this really sad look on his face. And he's like, you know, we can't afford that. So they were about to leave. And I walked up and I handed him my two extra tickets. I just gave them to him. The look on that kid's face when that Star Wars splashed on the screen just made me smile, because I was that age at one point too, you know?
I mean, yeah, it's unfortunate to know, you know, what that kid experienced for the next 2.5 hours. But I mean,
yeah, I was just thinking, after the movie, Dean now has a hit on his head.
Yeah, maybe after the movie, he trundles off with his dad to the nearest Huddle House or Waffle House and cries into his ham and egg.
I hate Star Wars.
Yeah, kid ended up feeling like we did after they killed off Optimus Prime in the Transformers movie.
So well, I mean, the movie was just so boring. I mean, I don't want to get off on this whole thing, but the movie was very boring in the middle. Like the action was stilted in the beginning. Like the action never felt like it went on long enough. And then you have this long, boring, boring stretch in the middle where nothing goes on. And I include the Tatooine stuff in that. Like, yeah, there's the pod race, but.
That was fluff already.
Yeah. Yeah.
That didn't need to be there to tell any story.
No, it was literally.
And that was the best part of the bloody thing.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, they could have called it, you know, Days of Thunder 2 or something at that point. Like there was no point to it. And I guess in order to kind of describe where my headspace was then, because I know that lots of people, including myself, are not liking these sequel films either, but I've already been through this heart crushing scenario with the prequels because I had been reading the books, and yeah, a lot of the books in the 90s weren't great, but they were the later books. The first books, the Zahn trilogy and a few of those initial Rogue Squadron books, along with those CD-ROM games, mm-hmm. were amazing. Like they were so much fun, you know, X-Wing and Dark Forces and Dark Forces was incredible.
Still have my copy.
Yeah, and all of that meant that anticipation with Star Wars for the people who kept the torch burning was still very much, you know, front of mind. It was still top of mind for us. And so then we walk into this thing and it's like, you know, I know Dean, you were just saying I was seeing a new Star Wars movie, and I was sitting there going, well, I saw a new Star Wars crawl, but I'm not sure what I've watched for the last 2.5 hours. And that continued for the other two films. And it was after the second film that I started to divorce myself mentally from this, what I thought would be a lifelong obligation to see Star Wars things day and date in the cinema or even at all. Mm. As a matter of fact, the only reason I went to see Revenge of the Sith was because I was working at the Athens, Georgia newspaper at the time. And I was like their student intern movie reporter. And so I went, they'd said, go watch Revenge of the Sith. And I was like, do I have to? And they're like, yeah. And so I went opening weekend to go see it at this small little theater. I wasn't even gonna go. And I went and I thought it was, you know, dog shit. And I came back and I wrote a review. They whittled that review down to 2 paragraphs because some, you know, local story became more important. And then I washed my hands of it. That was around the time that I sold off all of my prequel and 90s toys. Like I literally went hard into vintage at that point because everybody by Revenge of the Sith, the average fan, was so just immersed in, oh, I got to buy the next, you know, vintage collection, hyper-articulated, this and that. And I got to get the Revenge of the Sith line. I got to get Palpatine with the red lightsaber, and I got to get this and that. And somehow vintage prices had just stabilized in the market at that point. I was getting like boxed snow speeders for $24.95, buy it now.
Oh, wow.
And I'm going, yeah, forget this stuff. And I just offloaded all my Power of the Force 2, all the Episode 1 figures that I'd bought 2 months before Episode 1. I literally sold 40 carded episode one figures in a lot for $20 because nobody cared. Nobody cared. And it was weird. Nobody like me or possibly even Tom cared. But the people who did care, thankfully, outnumbered us. And so we were able to go in and get vintage stuff at really good prices. So that's what I did. I just went off on a rant, but I'm not going to apologize for it.
Because... Oh, no. You know me. I love your rants. Keep
that's
do it.
That's what we're here for.
2002 is about the time that I hung it up as well.
Yeah.
Because right after Revenge of the Sith, it was like, oh, my God, this isn't getting any better. And assholes are still running around looking for the, you know, the first episode one Darth Maul figure thinking it was going to be worth something. And this needs to stop.
It was embarrassing. It was like, oh, guys, yeah. Did you forget what quality was? Or did you ever know what quality was? Like, it started to separate the pew pew fans from the I get this fans. And I don't mean to sound like it's not gatekeeping. Everybody's allowed to be a fan of Star Wars in their own way. I'm not.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But it did start to show that there were people that saw this as a much more enriched and a property with a lot of depth, a story with a lot of depth, and they had invested a lot of emotional and intellectual capital in it in their youth. And they were literally being dragged behind the proverbial Nazi truck in Raiders on the prequels end of it. It's like, I felt like I've been thrown through a windshield. And I was debating whether or not to even keep hanging on to that whip at that point. It was like, you know what? If I just let go, I'm pretty sure the motorcycle will run over me and end all of this. So maybe I'm just going to let go. Like, I don't know if it's worth it to keep trying to get what they've got in the truck. Because what they've got in the truck isn't that good anymore. Man, I just talked myself into that. And that was awesome. And I'm going to own
it. Michael, what's the opposite of shill? Because that's what you are.
Yeah, it's... It's what is the opposite of shill? It's a guy named Oscar who lives in a trash can, I guess.
Like, yeah.
I don't know. I went out myself. I picked up a lot of the carded Phantom Menace figures. I put them in a box and I think they're still there. At one point I hung them on my wall, but a couple months after I saw the movie, I left for the Air Force. So everything was just there and it was still sitting there when I came home. But Russ, Art, did you guys grab any of the Phantom Menace stuff when it hit? Or
go ahead, Russ.
Oh, you can go ahead.
Oh, mine's probably boring, but I like I said, I bought the hardback novel. I think they put out like four different covers for it, but I bought the hardback novel. I read it and I was like, this is garbage, and so I didn't collect anything. I was already planning on leaving for the Navy. I didn't go see it in the theater. When it was announced that it was going to be a prequel, I was hoping that, you know, it would kind of go into like Han Solo's backstory a little bit. Like you'd see, like, because he existed, you know, while Vader was younger, Anakin was younger, but not at a child age. But I figured it would be a blended story of like an origin story of all of their origins kind of thing. And when there was no Millennium Falcon, no Chewbacca, really nothing that interested me, I checked out. And I actually didn't go see any of the other prequels in the theater. I think I ended up with one of my neighbors when I lived in Connecticut actually gave my stepson the VHS cassettes. And that was how I finally watched them.
The Phantom Menace probably would have been better if there were two things that would have happened, or you've got two scenarios. You've got an Anakin that's already a Jedi, or a Jedi that's in training and they're kicking ass for a first scene. I think that's a good startup. You don't need to go any further than that. Or you've got Anakin as a fetus.
Wait, say that again.
That's a joke that just kind of flopped. Damn it. I was thinking about that one for so long,
it,
too.
It really didn't flop. I was actually trying to figure out a way to build on it with a snarky like add-on. I failed, but I was totally with you, Tom. Like, making him a 9-year-old boy, what a mistake. Like, it was like Lucas was like, oh, yeah, you know, my kids are like this age, and it's really fun right now, and I'm going to put a little boy in this. It's like, don't do it, George. You're still
let's
a young
do, let, let's
man.
Yeah, for the first movie, let's hit the ground running with a great Jedi fight, killing stormtroopers or whatever. And of course, you know, we can get into the whole battle droid bullshit, but it's not heavy handed. It's episode one was soft handed, which we're starting a little too slow.
Yeah. And with an actor that can't pull it off. That's the other thing too. Like when you watch that behind the scenes documentary on episode one's DVD, you see a much better actor in the final screen tests. And George is like, he literally looks at his crew later when they're watching it on video. And he's like, well, you know, he's probably just been trained to nail an audition. And it's like, that's the point of an audition, George. You're supposed to nail it. What? You're literally choosing the kid that can't remember his lines and doesn't know how to deliver them. And at that point, you know, we've already been through Phantom Menace. I threw up my hands at that point. I knew that Attack of the Clones at that point was going to be a dog because I was like, this guy's out to lunch. I loved George Lucas. There's still things about him that I do love that have nothing to do with movies. But as far as his movie philosophy is concerned, he is out to lunch. He's the reason that the Clone Wars animated TV show was broken up and aired all out of order. He came into the writing room and was like, you know, it'd be cool. What if we like showed this episode first and then we went like 5 years in the future and showed this episode and then we jumped back before the episode before this one and showed an episode? And you're going, what? Like, I don't know.
Am I the only person in the world that didn't care for the Clone Wars show?
I
thought it was boring. I mean, I tried to get through it and I just couldn't do it. So
I don't think you're the only person in the world, but people have latched onto it who were prequel apologists. And now they're like, oh yeah, yeah, those prequels are bad, but this Clone Wars thing is really, really good. And it's like, it's okay. Like it's watchable. It's not setting my world on fire. Like I didn't have another Star Wars experience from it. You know, I'm like, oh yeah, it's them trying to take what's in the prequels and polish it and make it watchable because they can't stray from it. It's not like they could tell a whole new version of the prequels.
You're in trouble when your movie needs supplemental material to make it good.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. What he said. Yeah.
Personally, I haven't seen the Clone Wars at all. I've not watched any of it.
Like I said, it's not bad, but it's not what everybody says it is. They act like it's the second coming of Jesus, and it's not. It's just a competent show that tries to buoy a really unpopular movie trilogy. It's like, well, we can explain this kind of stuff away, and we can kind of make this stuff make sense, and we can kind of retcon in some explanations here and there. And it's like, yeah, we can make Anakin likable. And do they? Yeah, they do actually make Anakin likable in that show. But when you go back and watch the films, it doesn't. I think people are fooling themselves when they're like, yeah, you know, the show really made me appreciate Anakin, so that when I go back and watch the prequels, I'm like, when you go back and watch the prequels, you're not even looking at the same character. He's not the same person. There really isn't any continuity between the prequel movies and that show. A lot better than the prequels. I could take it or leave it, though, as an experience. Like, you know, that ship has sailed, George. It's sailed. And
well, the holiday special wasn't used to retcon Star Wars. It didn't need it.
Right.
It was some TV producer's half-ass attempt to keep it going.
Right.
But the thing is, you know, going back, the people were clamoring for Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And by 1999, Star Wars was already a thing. So it's amazing that it was still incredibly popular, because the thing is, the prequels, people were, especially the Phantom Menace, people were expecting something that they were expecting in their own minds, but what they got was not what they wanted.
Right.
So their expectations were too high for what was delivered.
I don't think it's the fans' fault. I think you had Star Wars pushed in your face everywhere. And you were led to believe that this was going to be the most amazing thing since, you know, sliced bread. And they were, you were thinking, how could Star Wars fail at this point? I mean, it's, I'm eating Jedi chicken and eating Jar Jar tacos. How can this turn into a shit sandwich? And when it was released, it was like, once again, you know, we're trying to make ourselves like it. You just can't.
I don't know. I think I have an answer for that, Tom. Disney. When I walked into a grocery store one day and I saw BB-8 oranges, I knew we had gone too far at this point.
Well, there was a, did you know that Star Wars has always associated itself with marketing? I mean, you walk into a 7-Eleven and you've got the trading cards and all this stuff. But yeah, BB-8 oranges are definitely over the top. But the thing is, the pieces started to show there. The house made of cards was already starting to falter after Star Wars, if you ask me. I mean, if you've ever read the bracket adaption of The Empire Strikes Back, thank God that was saved, because that was probably going to be a disaster.
Yeah, and what I would argue about the bracket draft is that while, yes, it needed a lot of work, people now have been like, well, it's a good thing Lawrence Kasdan took it over and really fixed it. And it's like, you know, Lee Brackett was a very talented writer that went all the way back to the golden age of Hollywood. And she was very talented, but she had cancer and she died. She didn't have a chance to do a second write-up after having a meeting with Lucas with notes, you know, because Lucas would give him notes and then they would go back and punch it up. All the bones of Empire are right there. But Lucas, you know, even with his direction, he doesn't give a lot of direction at first. He like waits for you to F up and then he tries to correct. Like, he does take one and then he's like, oh no, do it faster, you know, and everybody's like, oh, okay, we're not really sure what you want. So I have this suspicion that he didn't give Lee Brackett much more than these are the bones of it, and she kind of right. wrote it down and filled out everything that she thought would work, and then she never had the opportunity to do a second pass because she literally died. Lawrence Kasdan, on the other hand, who
Kirshner.
Not or what's that?
Kirshner.
I'm thinking of the writer, Lawrence Kasdan.
Oh, came, okay. Yeah. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
So Kasdan comes in and he gets the first draft and he gets all of Lucas's notes about, I don't like this and I don't like this and I don't like that. So he literally goes and just follows Lucas's notes, probably does some dialogue changes or whatever, comes back with it. And for even me, for like 30 years, he was lauded as this hero. Hail the conquering hero. Lawrence Kasdan's the best ever. But then when you look at the transcripts in Rensselaer's Making of Return of the Jedi between Kasdan and Kazanjian and Lucas, mm-hmm. and then you look at what he did on Force Awakens as a writer, and then you look at what he and his son did on Solo, I'm starting to believe that Emperor has no clothes either. Because it's like, well, maybe he was given too much credit for Empire Strikes Back. You know, he was just following orders, you know, like he was just doing what he needed to do, because George is kind of a control freak in some, back then, in a good way. Am I making sense or am I just sounding like a crazy person?
No,
I'm with you.
Yeah. Yeah. So like Lawrence Kasdan, yeah, he helped contribute to my favorite movie of my childhood, Empire Strikes Back, and salute to him for it. But after seeing the Lee Brackett draft, I'm going, and knowing what Lee Brackett worked on in her own career, I'm going, I have no doubt, I have no lack of confidence that she would have turned in a very good second draft as well. He had the benefit of knowing what George didn't like about the first draft. And then on Jedi, he had all these crazy ideas that George even backed off of. So when you hear Kasdan's ideas about stuff like, you know, in the end of the movie, George, I think it'd be really good if like Luke put on Darth Vader's helmet and sat in the Emperor's chair, and that was the end of the movie. And Lucas is like, no, you know, like, so I sit back and I reevaluate and I'm like, I will always acknowledge Kasdan's contribution to Star Wars, but I will no longer overinflate it with other people's contributions. So it's like when people say that George Lucas was the be all end all mastermind of the original trilogy and it had it all planned out. And it's like, if you just read a few conversations with Gary Kurtz around the release of Attack of the Clones, we all know that shit ain't true. Like, but people still worship him.
I'm pretty convinced that Gary Kurtz saved Star Wars.
Yeah. Yeah. He totally did. But there's a lot
because if you left it to George, Star Wars would have never been anything further than Star Wars. I know that for a fact. I don't know that for a fact. I don't think it would have been half as good.
No, it wouldn't have. I mean, the guy was literally so anxious during the making of it that he was cutting his own hair off and putting it in a trash can in his office compulsively. Like, he was literally clipping his own hair off. He was so wound up and anxiety ridden. And you're good sitting Lord. There going, no wonder they handed off the script to Huck and Katz, the people who would eventually write Temple of Doom. And then they would direct Howard the Duck. We're going to ride right past that last point. But the point is that they knew how to punch up dialogue. And so they punched up the original Star Wars and made it what we love about it. You know, because the original drafts of Star Wars are just bonkers. You know, the original crawl, Mace Windu, a Jedi Bindu from the planet of Ovuchi, must go to Aqualay for the blah, 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 you know. And it's like, blah, 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 blah. Like, I don't even know what I'm reading here. A lot of people were involved in that. Kurtz, Huck, Katz, Lee Brackett. Irvin Kershner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I had always thought, I thought I saw an interview somewhere with Lucas many moons ago where he said the whole thing, like Star Wars through Jedi, was one long movie. It was too big. So he cut it in half and decided to do this part.
Right. But see, what happened was he wrote this big, long treatment that was Mace Windu, a Jedi Bindu from Ofuchi, who has to go to the planet of Aqualay to, I don't know, bounce in a bouncy castle or something. I don't know what it was, but he has to go do all this weird stuff. And he had this long thing. And then they were like, oh, well, when he says I took the middle bit, what he's really saying is my treatment had a middle bit that was the Civil War. And that probably in a treatment was maybe like, most 2 pages of longhand paragraphs just kind of describing the overall beats. And he took that out. And then they started really pounding out, well, what's the first script going to be? And so, like, we know for a fact that his original idea for that middle part of the trilogy was the Death Star was at the end of the third movie. It was the big climax. But he said, since I didn't know if I was ever going to be able to do more than one film, I wanted that ending at the ending of the first movie that I did, because I wanted to do that, because that was like the thing he was most excited about, which is why he ended up redoing it in the end of Return of the Jedi, because his technology would allow him to do it better.
Right.
But they were shuffling parts around after he decided to do, I'm going to do this first, which is the middle bit, because it's the most interesting. And people helped him with that decision. Like, other people were reading his stuff and going, Alan Ladd and Gary Kurtz and other people were saying, this is the most interesting section so far. Let's start here. But if you took that out and read it the way it was right off that page, you wouldn't recognize it. Because then they took the first third of that and went, all right, let's change this and that. And maybe Han Solo shouldn't be a lizard man. And maybe they all shouldn't be Asian people. That was a real thing at one point. And maybe, you know, Luke and his friend Obi-Wan shouldn't be little people and everybody else is large, which he then aped that for Willow. Like, there were all these weird ideas and they kept just throwing them in the trash going, George, we need you to focus. Like, we need, take your Ritalin. Let's get there. So, like, it was a crazy process. So,
well, the concept for Star Wars was shopped around with the movie house. I mean, the movie studios for a couple of years.
Yeah,
no one wanted to pick it up because it just, I think it just scared the shit out of everybody. It's like, why do I want to invest a movie? Why do I want to invest movie in this hodgepodge of nonsense?
Yep.
So and it then, was, yeah. It wasn't even coherent at the time. These early drafts, because I've seen some stuff, but I've never, like, midgets. I didn't know that would.
Oh yeah, he had a concept where he wanted Luke and Obi-Wan and them to leave their planet for the first time and then find out that the rest of the galaxy is populated by normal sized people, which he then used in Willow. And then another concept was he wanted everybody in the movie to be Asian because of his love of like Japanese sci-fi or something. And that was one idea. And
he got hopping kind of Wookiees then.
Say what?
I said we'd have gotten hopping Wookiees.
Well, the aliens were probably going to still be there, but all the humans were going to be Asian people. Like, that was one of his ideas. He just was kind of scattershot. Like, he was all over the place. And, you know, Gary Kurtz and guys like that were trying to help him focus it and make it palatable. And Alan Ladd, of course, was, as Tom, you know, knows as well, Alan Ladd was really, you know, putting his neck on the line as they were going through production. And at one point, he hadn't even seen a scrap of footage yet. And the entire board of directors at 20th Century Fox wanted to shit can the whole production because it was over budget. It was over schedule. And they wanted to pull the plug. And Alan Ladd Jr. just looked at them all and he said, "This is the greatest movie ever made." And then he got up and left the room. He never seen one scrap of footage. He was just like, "I believe in George Lucas." And
well, thank God for Macquarie's concept art too.
Yes. Right. Yes. That stuff I've
seen. No one would have ever picked it up if they hadn't seen any of that.
Right. And thank God it wasn't 1999 script for episode one that Alan Ladd was blindly defending. He was defending a script that got worked on with the help of Ralph McQuarrie's artwork and William Huck and Gloria Katz's ghostwriting and Gary Kurtz's input into massaging the story into something coherent. There were a lot of factors that gave Alan Ladd the psychological capital to be able to say that in that room and not lose his head over it after it was over. Because when George Lucas became a unilaterally controlling director around the time of Return of the Jedi, and the only thing stopping him was technological limitations, everything starts to markedly nosedive in quality by the time you get to Phantom Menace. If he had been able to make a Phantom Menace style movie back in 1977, I don't think there'd be any more of those films. I think it'd be dead.
Well, I think George went in with Star Wars. This was going to be a one and done.
Yeah. Yeah. Because yeah, I didn't think it was going to go anywhere.
Yeah, because I had remembered an interview, I believe, I saw with Lucas where he says, you know, with opening weekend, you know, that he gets a call. This is going to be huge. You know, this is going to be giant. He's like, look, all sci-fi does good opening weekend. Let's wait and see how it does. And then it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Did that force his hand to make a sequel?
I think from a movie making standpoint and a money making standpoint, it was like, yes, let's keep this going.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, very much so. He wanted to be a part. He wanted to be a part, meaning not a part, but a part from the studio system. He didn't want to be controlled by them. His whole dream was to have his own independent movie studio. And so he saw the profits from this come in, and he had wisely finagled the merchandising rights away from 20th Century Fox on the initial deal, because they didn't care about, you know, after their experience on Planet of the Apes and other things, they felt like merchandising doesn't make money. There's a law of diminishing returns on sequels and especially sci-fi, so we don't care. Well, when Star Wars went through the roof with all that stuff, that's one of the reasons that Alan Ladd Jr. finally left 20th Century Fox, because even though he had fought for and made their biggest hit ever, they were like, "Can't believe you were stupid enough to not get the merchandising rights, Alan. This is ridiculous." And now he wants to distribute the sequel on our backs, but we get even less profit for it. You know, they were mad at him about that. But George saw an opportunity to fund his own movie with his own creative control. But what happened? By his own admission, he was like, controlling the money as an executive producer is this massive job on its own. So now I don't feel like I can actually have the time to direct it or even write it. So now I got to hire all these other people to do that. What he didn't expect was they weren't going to act like TV directors and writers that take their response or their marching orders from the executive producer.
Right.
They were movie professionals and they took their jobs very seriously and rightfully so. And they pushed back to make the best movie possible, which incensed George, because like the first movie, it went over schedule, it went over budget. Bank of America tried to pull their loan on the Star Wars sequel and call it in. I mean, it was a bad situation. George had to like, I can't remember, sometimes I get his story mixed up with the Salkinds and Superman. I can't remember if George had to, I don't think he had to ask for more money from 20th Century Fox or make a deal, but maybe he did to try and kick it over the line. I can't remember what happened with that. I know that the Superman production, the Salkinds, had to go back to Warner Brothers and give them more rights and benefits and royalties to get the money they made to finish the film or something. But right. with Empire, I can't remember. But he was incensed after that. And he was like, you know, he told Gary Kurtz, he's like, we could have made this movie in half the time for half the amount of money and it still would have done just fine. And Gary Kurtz was like, yeah, but George, it was worth it. And he's like, no, it wasn't. And Gary was like, I'm going to go make The Dark Crystal. Bye. I don't want to do Return of the Jedi with you, because he was changing the plan at that point. And he was, you know, his marriage was on the rocks. It was headed towards, you know, a cliff. And yeah, it was, there are a lot of egos involved in these kind of things. And sometimes I think the greatest tragedy is that you, when you're in the middle of that level of success and you don't realize that the team has all gotten there together. And if you pull one part of that team away, it all starts to kind of collapse. Unravel. And people can say all day, well, the Star Wars films still make money. They make tons of money. And I always argue, I'm like, the Star Wars franchise has been riding off the reputation of 2.5 movies for 40 years. The hype train where people go in droves to see the next one and see the next one, no matter, like, as Tom said, no matter if it's starring a fetus or if it's starring a digital frog or whatever it is, they keep coming in droves. It's because they always bank on, well, remember, these are the follow-ups to those 2.5 great movies. And it's like, yeah, and maybe that's where it should have ended. Like, maybe that should have been it. I know I sound like a grumpy bastard, so I, you know.
No, it's, I love it. But it's, you know, I've, at least as far as the new films go, I've said to some of my buddies, you could take just a black starfield and put the word Star Wars over it for 2.5 hours. People will line up in droves to see it. They will see anything with the word Star Wars on it without any context or even halfway decent storytelling.
Well, I'll take it one step further. Sure. People are willing to look at, you know, anything that's got Star Wars on it and then feel obligated to like it. People will feel obligated to love it, and they don't have to. I mean, if it's garbage, let's call a spade a garden hose. I mean, you know, a garden tool, right?
Right.
I mean, Star Wars now is like a big shitty buffet. You know, you're always going to go for the fried chicken, but you don't need to like the meatloaf.
Yeah.
And most of it now is being served. You know, we're mostly being served meatloaf now at this point.
Star Wars is now that he's the youngest kid in a family where he's the sibling that got coddled, and now he's a teenager that's like stealing cars and graffitiing bridges. And the parents are like, oh, but it's still sweet little Star Wars. You remember sweet little Star Wars? And you're sitting there going, Mom, he's a rat. Like, he's no good anymore. And she's like, no. And, you know, she's in denial. And that's how I look at Star Wars now. It's like everybody's making excuses for what is literally on legal paper an intellectual property. It's not magic anymore. It's just a widget. And that's what they've turned it into, is a money generating widget. But if all of the Forbes stuff is to be believed, that money generating widget is really on middling ground right now. It's no longer the consistent money maker it once was. There's a lot of variable in there and a lot of chaos and a lot of, all right, I don't believe in the whole idea of hot take, especially after I've already laid the groundwork that, you know, I'm not going to shill for anything. And I have very brutal opinions about this stuff, but we talked about Clone Wars a second ago and how Clone Wars is this thing that people just use as this way to try and say, oh, no, there's still good Star Wars. Look at the Clone Wars. And you go, it's okay. Like, it's not bad, but it's not setting the world on fire. Now let's take that a step further. Let's talk about The Mandalorian.
Okay.
It's not bad, but is it, like, I remember in Thor Ragnarok, you know, where he's like, really? But are you? Like, is Mandalorian really as great as everybody claims it is? Like, is it really that, like, oh, like, is it? I don't think so. Like, I've seen some of it. It still looks very digital. It looks very prequely. The gun battles aren't really that kinetic. They look there are no muzzle flashes anymore because they're doing all of it in this like
Hollywood CGI
studio dome. Remember in the original films how they had you real blanks and the guns really shot and it gave it some visceral immediacy? Yep. And now there's none of that. It looks like they're just playing Photon. Like there's something about, like, again, the scripts are so far superior to the sequels and the prequels, but they're nowhere near the original trilogy. I think people are continuing to make excuses for this kid that can't get his shit together. And he can't get his shit together because the people leading it, they're not very good at their jobs. Like, you know, the president and some of the writers and everybody's sort of like tied to it in ways where they're, you know, they got one hand tied behind their back and they're hopping on one foot trying to write a good story. But the president is like, no, keep hopping on one foot, amuse me. You know, like it's not working. And I argue it hasn't worked. All right, how do I put this? Because now I'm reevaluating. Star Wars worked through dysfunction for the first two films. In other words, there was a lot of fighting, but it was all towards making the best movies possible. Now there's money involved. Massive, massive amounts of money. All the creators since then have had that on their mind. How do we make new toys? How do we do this? How do we do that? And it's just whittled everything down to the point that I don't care about Mandalorian or anything anymore. I'm looking at stories that are new ideas, and even old things that I've never seen before. Because we've got a century of entertainment that most people don't watch the first 80 years of. Most people stay within 20 years ago to now, or maybe in this case, 40 to now, because Star Wars was 40 years ago. Sure. A lot of our generation, look at this, I'm just going to go off on, boy, Michael just went off on this big thing, but a lot of our generation's problem is that we, as Gen X, and millennials are worse about it, and Xennials are even worse than that, is that they sit back and they're like, oh, well, if it's older than 5 years ago, that's old, and I don't want to watch that. And for us, it's like, well, if it didn't happen in our lifetime, it's old. And I sit back and I'm like, there are so many great and better stories, better, yeah, I said better, than Star Wars that are out there that were made before it, that were made after it, that nobody watches, because most of our generation got so expertly marketed to for 25 years. Like, we were the first generation where they had perfected predatory marketing, not Lucas meaning, but the system, the commercials, the cartoons, the breakfast cereal, the posters, the toys, the this, sure, that. Collect them all. And it's like, now half our generation is just like, I can't get away from my feels. I love my feels for the thing that I had when I was five. It's the only thing in the world. It's the greatest thing ever. And it's like, you're a douche.
At this point, I would be more excited about a re-release of the Apple Dumpling Gang than watch another Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
I think Star Wars either needs to go into some serious, serious rehab, which I think Filoni is really trying with Mandalorian, or what they need to do is just throw this fucking franchise right into a truck and just hope it gets destroyed completely and we never see it again. A lot of people say that Star Wars should have ended in 83. I'm one of those people.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm there. In fact, I say there's three Star Wars movies and the rest is high budget fan fiction from whoever.
That's right. That's perfect. Rush. That's right.
That's perfect.
But I kind of feel like they've done that with other franchises. I mean, like, look at Ghostbusters.
Look at Ghostbusters. Look how they've destroyed Ghostbusters now. And now we've got another movie that they're trying to pull this jet. It's 5 feet from the ground, and what they're trying to do is pull it out of this nosedive. They're not going to be able to, because that last film completely destroyed it.
Yeah,
I mean, the passengers in this plane are all dead. They died in 1984.
Yeah, faintly, if you listen, if you put a shell up to your ear, Tom, you can hear the entire fan base for Ghostbusters yelling, "Chappie!" And then it just boom, like it's ridiculous.
I don't know. Where every franchise has been destroyed. Name one. Yeah. We'll tear them apart piece by piece.
Yeah, I was actually going to go on to say that, yeah, they've done the same thing with Star Trek as well.
Mm. Exactly.
And you notice there's one
Predator
tied to the two big ones here.
Doctor Who.
J.J. Abrams.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. J.J. Abrams is like the angel of death for all of these franchises. And the sad part is that in many ways, he's kind of like the coronavirus. Like, he snuck up on everybody before they figured out what was going on. And he's moved from nation to nation. And he's like, oh, crap. They figured out my game over at Star Wars and Star Trek. Quick, let's get that deal inked with Warner Brothers for DC before they figure out who I am. And they're like, sure, we'll give you Superman and Batman. And in the background, someone is trying to run through the gates of the studio to stop the signing, like Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate. He's like, you know, no, like he's banging on the glass, but it's too late. Everything's been signed. And now Abrams is going to destroy that too. That's where
Abrams kind of looks like Steven Spielberg. Let's give him a shot.
It's the glasses.
and even other properties like Indy 5. I was excited about it, and then
Why?
When I found
Did you
out
see Indy 4? Well,
yes. Hold on. Wait.
Are you hitting your head with a brass mallet every Wednesday or something? Like trying to, like, what
Tuesdays,
are you doing to yourself?
Tuesday.
Okay.
So, yes, Indy 4 sucked. There's no other way around it. And I even own it on DVD just so I can complete everything.
Apple Dumpling Gang's looking pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah. But Spielberg even said, okay, we know this is bad. The four was bad. So he was on board to help out with 5. And then when he saw what they were doing it, he even backed out and says, I want nothing to do with this.
Yeah, because he was the one that relented on 4. He played a game of chicken that he, by his own admission, with George Lucas for like almost a decade, because George was like, it's gotta be aliens. And Spielberg was like, ah. And he and Harrison were like, if we're ever gonna do this, we're just gonna have to give in to George. Well, I don't think he ever wanted to make that compromise again. And I'm sure with this Disney-owned thing, he probably saw the very first red flags and went, nope, I said after Indy 4, I would not compromise my principles on this character again. I'm out. I bet you that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, mm-hmm. I watched a Dunecock video. He was discussing Indy 5. And when they brought up the writer's name, he even said, I'm done. I have no hope for this. It's gone. And I think Harrison Ford's now revisiting these old properties just for a paycheck.
Yeah, well, he needs it because, I mean, I don't think his divorce to his former wife, Melissa Matheson, I think that still financially hurt him. I think he's still trying to crawl back from his losses after deciding to marry Ally McBeal. I really do.
Like, he
lost half of his 90s, you know, FU money. He lost all of that in that divorce. Yeah. California law. So,
am I glad I don't live in California.
But yeah.
So you mentioned the marketing. Let's go here. Kenner. Kenner Star
all
Wars.
Right. Here there be dragons. All right. Let's
back. I think like Art and Russ, I was a Star Wars kid. Almost every Christmas, it was all Star Wars stuff. Mm-hmm. Earliest memories of Star Wars toys, where do you go from there? Like your happiest memory of receiving something Star Wars that your eyes popped out of your head?
Well, I'm going to defer to the first answer to Tom on this because he beat me to it by a few years.
Thanks, Michael.
Well, no, I didn't mean, I literally mean that, like, you
have,
yeah, you have the first memories of the first toys hitting the stores, mm-hmm. and that's the story that needs to be heard first. It wasn't a slam or anything.
No, I'm just thinking because I wasn't ready to answer.
Oh, well, if you want me to, I can jump in there and then you do what you need to do.
Well, I'm gonna take your invite. Thanks. So okay. I'm gonna do this and then we'll kick it back off to you, Michael. Don't worry about that.
I don't care. So.
No, I think the first memory I had was I was standing in the aisles of a Kmart and the figures had just come out. there's a woman who walked up to me and said, you know, I'm going to buy some toys for my child. It's his birthday. He's really into this Star Wars. And what he would like are these figures, but I don't know which figures to get him. I want to get him two. And of course, I took a look and there was the golden C-3PO and the, you know, the shiny domed R2. And I wanted these figures. And I made this suggestion that, well, if you're going to get figures, you definitely need to get the C-3PO and R2-D2. Because they are definitely the coolest and the most attractive, you know, sitting on the shelves. And so off they went. And I think I ended up, and my first figure was, what was my first figure? It must have been Obi-Wan Kenobi, of course. Because I think Obi-Wan was actually a peg warmer back then. But Obi-Wan was my first figure. And I have a special place in my heart. I would have loved to get the 3PO and R2, but it just wasn't in the cards. And I guess I'm the one that kind of screwed that up for myself. But yeah, when you see the figures in the stores, we had a little, we didn't have a Walmart and we surely didn't have Toys R Us in Idaho where I lived, but Star Wars had taken over the toy aisles by that time. Of course, that was 78. And with just 12 figures, man, it was magic to see just these 12 figures on the shelf. It was incredible. So my first was Obi-Wan, and how awesome was that to just see toys on the shelves after seeing a movie that was just so amazing, and then actually getting to hold a piece of the movie in your hand. And it was fun. So mine was Obi-Wan, and yes, when you ask what it was like to have Star Wars in your life when you're a kid, and your first figure, that first figure is always one you remember.
How did you acquire it, Tom? Was it like a birthday present, or how'd you get it?
I don't recall. I think it was the same time that I had showed this lady these figures. I think that was the time where I got the Obi-Wan. So that was at my local Kmart. Yeah, I think my mom was shopping elsewhere for, you know, either getting us those great ham sandwiches at Kmart, or some, I don't know, crappy shirts or something somewhere. But it wasn't like a Christmas kind of thing. It was definitely you know, begging. My parents were quick to not go to the toy aisle with me when I was a kid. I had to meet them elsewhere, so I wouldn't talk them into getting me yet another figure.
That's some sinister strategizing they did there, Tom.
Well, it was the same thing with arcade games and stuff. I was not allowed to go anywhere where they had arcade games, because the first thing that I would ask, it was for a quarter.
Right.
Michael?
My first action figure was right after I saw the movie at that guy's house, the Berkeleys. We were at a Kroger that was right across about a mile from, it was the Kroger we always went to grocery shop. And my mom went there with me that day, and we were shopping. And, you know, back then Star Wars figures were everywhere. I mean, they were sold everywhere. There wasn't the problem we have now where all the toys are at big box stores and the pegs are always empty. It was a different time. There was an end cap that was filled. It was one of those custom Kenner cardboard stand-up things you put on the end of an aisle that had the cubbies that you put all the figures in. And it was kind of like two, you know, and they were filled to the gills. And I picked out Chewbacca because I remembered him from the movie, obviously, because I'd only seen the first film, which, you know, I'd just seen it. And we got R2-D2 with the sensor scope, because that was the version that was out then. And my brother was stupid and took the R2-D2 into the bathtub with him that night. That was dumb, because he had that sticker. So his sticker was instantly ruined. But I ended up with a few other R2-D2s over the years as a kid. So that loss was mitigated somewhat. So then I started collecting them. I think it was, I want to say my next action figure was Hoth Luke's, no. Is that right? One of my next action figures was Hoth Luke Skywalker. And then right after that, Darth Vader. and I didn't have any context for Hoth Luke because I had no way to see Empire Strikes Back. I had the read along cassette a few months later. So I was able to kind of glean, you know, the story, but I just liked it because it was the first Luke Skywalker I'd ever seen. And he was my favorite character. Mm-hmm. And so I got Luke. Then we got Darth Vader at Target. Hoth Luke was at Hills. Target was where I found Darth Vader. Then our neighbors across the street came over one day. They, you know, back when we all knew our neighbors and we were all friends.
Oh, sure.
And they brought us gifts and I had to pick out, they did the thing where they hide one around each arm around the back and you got to pick the arm. Cause my brother was like not even three, I think. And so they were always getting him one too, which I resented. So I had to pick which arm and I picked the arm. Squid Head comes around. Well, I hadn't seen Return of the Jedi yet. I think it was just about to come out if it hadn't already. It was like the spring of 83 or whatever. And all I saw was this dude that, you know, had like these tentacles coming off of his face and he was wearing a dress. And I was just like, and because the other figure was a sand person. And I knew what that was because I'd seen that movie. And I cried like a bitch. Like I was just... And, you know, it only took me a little while to finally realize, you know, that Squidhead was actually a very playable character. Like he had a pistol, you know, he actually had some really nice stuff going on with the cape and everything. And he was a cool alien bad guy. And so, you know, my melancholy subsided. But yeah, those were like my first memories with Star Wars stuff. I mean, I kind of remember where I was every time I got a figure. It's weird.
Art?
I'm not sure.
My first toys, I think, of Star Wars were I got a pack of ball cards. Uh-huh. There was like one was C-3PO, they were all in, almost all of the pictures were inside the Sandcrawler, except for the, there was a picture of a, or one of the cards had one of the sand people on it. And I was completely fascinated with that. And then I think for my fifth birthday, I got the read-along records for all three or all of the movies that were out at that time. Jedi wasn't out yet. And for my fifth birthday, I got a Chewbacca action figure. And I remember opening it and I was looking at the pile of presents I still had to open yet from all my aunts and uncles and grandparents. And I was looking at my younger sister and I felt bad she didn't have anything. So I gave her the Chewbacca. And she was instantly convinced it was a teddy bear. So, and to this day, she still has it. I didn't get any more original action figures till I was scouring like yard sales and stuff sometime around 86, 87.
Russ?
I remember seeing vaguely the original Star Wars logo on packages as a kid. My mom would not allow me to have Star Wars figures because she thought the aliens were ugly. So I would see these toys and I would, you know, it wasn't until probably February of 1984, we were at JAFCO looking at all the Return of the Jedi figures that were out. She let me get a Luke Skywalker Jedi and I was just mesmerized. I finally have a Star Wars figure. I didn't even open it. You know, when you get a toy, you rip it out of the package. When you're in the car, you lose half the accessories.
Yep.
All the way from Salem, which is probably about only a, you know, short drive, all the way home. I'm just sitting there looking at the packaging, the back of it, looking at all the different figures you can get. Of course, I lost the gun later that day. I kept the lightsaber for several years. Just one of those things where I still have a piece of the card back to this day that I had cut out of Luke Skywalker. I used this as a bookmark. But it was probably after that, just a few days later, my sister had me down at our local Sprouse Ritz and I got Darth Vader. Then I saw that you could get a free action figure, and then I just started grabbing what I could to try and get enough proof of purchases to send in for the Emperor. And of course, at that time, the offer expired, and I never got my Emperor figure. But
Sprouse Ritz, I think you and I are the only ones who know what the hell that is.
Oh, yeah. That's In Silverton, it was the only place to really find any toys without going to Salem. And Salem, I compare it to being like Little House on the Prairie. Oh boy, it's our monthly trip to go to the big city, you know. So we'd all load up and head over to Lancaster Mall in Salem. And we didn't have a Toys R Us in Salem until 85. And the only time they had Star Wars was at the end when they had clearances. And I got quite a few figures as a kid when they hit the 99-cent bargain bin. Other than that, I think I had maybe five figures until they got, you know, until they were cheap. I never got Star Wars for Christmas as a kid. It was kind of, in one way, it was a forbidden fruit. I had tons of G.I. Joe stuff. Dad was all like, hey, let's get this kid some military toys. But Star Wars, and I think part of that's the reason why 1991, after getting the trilogy on VHS, the lack of being allowed to get them drove my need to collect them.
I totally get that. Makes sense.
I can see that.
Yep.
I mean, you know, I'm probably the only person here that doesn't remember the first figure I ever got. I want to say it was Darth Vader, but I might be wrong. I do know in 1980 was a Star Wars Christmas. I got my first Falcon in 80, a lot of vehicles. But the Falcon for me was like my golden fleece, I guess. That was the one that always sticks out in my head. Fortunately, all of my toys stolen out of a garage in the 90s when we went out to California, including all my Star Wars stuff. I'm slowly getting it all back, but yeah, I want to say Vader, but I might be wrong. I probably that, or if it wasn't Vader, it was a Stormtrooper, one of the two. So as things go, obviously, favorite Star Wars movies, Michael, obviously yours is Empire, hands down out of all of them. Did that influence your collecting as a child? Not necessarily as an adult, but as a child.
The problem that I found myself in was I saw Return of the Jedi in the summer of 83 on its initial release. I had no way of seeing Empire, but my next door neighbor's kids, the next door neighbor kids right next to our house where we played with them all the time, and they were slightly older than us. And so they had all the Empire stuff. And I didn't really know what the context of it was. All I knew was it looked so freaking cool. Like it looked cooler than any of the stuff that I was getting in the Jedi line. Then don't get me wrong, like I was excited to ask for the Jabba the Hutt play set for my birthday and the Scout Walker and the speeder bikes. And you know, the Rancor was really fun because you found out he could swallow the smaller characters and stuff like that. So there was a lot of play value in them. But when you're a kid, you're limited to what you have access to. And so like I didn't have access to Empire Strikes Back as a movie until the rental appearance of it in the fall of 84. So everything I had was just scant pictures in a read-along book. I had maybe the card back on the back with all the figures on it, but I didn't have anything to tell me what the vehicles were from Empire, this and that. I didn't know it would be my favorite film. So I ended up playing with a lot of stuff from my next door neighbors. And the figures on the back, I could see. So the figures on the back became really interesting to me. And so I was like, by late 83, I was going, you know what, Mom, I really want what I called Snow Han to go with my Snow Luke Skywalker. I wanted Han Solo. I picked him up on a trip with my dad, Bespin Han, because I wanted him to fly the Falcon. But I didn't, all I had were those pictures in the read-along book and the thing on the back. So my focus was on getting the figures from Empire because I didn't know what all the other stuff was. Eventually I went to birthday parties at kids' houses and stuff. And I would see the snow speeder, which became my grail. I never got, like, the snow speeder was that ship I always wanted that truly got away. I saw the Dagobah playset, you know, in a store at Lionel Toy World one time. And I was like, oh my God, there's a Dagobah playset. And then I got dragged away because we were just there to look around, you know, which was terrible. And you know, my last real Star Wars purchase in a store at retail price was in 1989, when I went into a store. I kid you not, I went into a small mom and pop toy shop, not an antique store, not a secondhand store. They were a current run little toy store in Nashville, and up on the top shelf with a nice layer of dust on it was a boxed Empire Strikes Back cloud car.
Oh, wow. And,
you know, so my Star Wars obsession, interest, enthusiasm with the toys, especially when 1985 hit, it was sad because I tried to get into Voltron, but then there was the lead scare and all the cool diecast ones got pulled away. And I was like, it's not as cool as Star Wars anyway. And then I tried to get into Mask, and I tried to get into G.I. Joe and Transformers. And I tried very, very briefly to get into Silverhawks until I found out with one toy that those things blow. And so I was like, nope. So it was always trying to fill that void toy wise that Star Wars was always on top and nothing could beat it. Like G.I. Joe was fun, and I ended up just committing to that mainly because they were compatible. But I'll never say that G.I. Joe was like Star Wars. I loved the Star Wars stuff the most. And that's why even in the late 80s, I got my mom to take me to the Nashville Fairgrounds to go to the big flea market there so that I could find more of the Empire figures that I never found on pegs. Like, and I bought them secondhand with no accessories. I got Hoth Leia finally, and I got 2-1B, and I got the TIE fighter pilot and a, you know, really beaten up snowtrooper, but I didn't care because that was the only way to get them at that point. You know, I was a kid still playing with them. Yeah. So the Empire thing, when I finally saw the movie, I was so glad I already had some of the figures from it and tried to find more, but I never could get the big stuff from Empire because the Jedi stuff flooded the toy shelves at that point. And they phased out the Empire vehicles. The characters were still there, but the vehicles and everything weren't. The day that I got Hoth Luke Skywalker, I didn't know anything about, I'd only seen the first movie. It was like my third action figure. And the thing that kicked me in the tail for the rest of my life was the fact that on that shelf rack were all the Hoth mini rigs, including the Wampa and the Tauntaun. But I didn't know what the hell those were. And so when my mom said you can get a ride, because she was Southern and she said you can get a ride, I was like, cool, I could get one of these little rides. Well, I got the MTV7 because it was like a steamroller with a cannon mm-hmm. on it. And I was like, oh, cool. But once I saw the movie, I was like, oh, I wish I had a Tauntaun. Well, by that point, it wasn't 1982 anymore.
Right.
It was 83 or 84. Tauntauns were gone. You couldn't find a Tauntaun anymore. So I never had one of those in childhood either. So it was that, and I know I sound like I've got like these great laments, but you know, when you start thinking about it, trying to answer these questions, it's like, yeah, that was how Empire guided my collecting. Was Empire was more of a realization of the things I couldn't ever find or have as a kid.
Right. Because
it was too late, you know? Yeah.
You were lucky though, Michael, because you kind of, you know, you kind of dipped your foot into quite a few toy franchises. I feel like I can talk about Star Wars and that's it. I'm a one trick pony.
Yeah, but Tom, I gotta tell you, as you can attest from the truly, you know, amazing and laudable success of igrewupstarwars.com, there is no igrewupmask.com. There is no igrewupsilverhawks.com. Why? Because nobody effing cares. and there's a reason, because those toy lines, yeah, they're nifty as a curio, but they're not culturally pivoting moments. They're not impactful. they're not universally, like, we're all sitting here right now talking about collective experiences with the Star Wars franchise, even with a few years of age difference. Not one of us could really do a 5-person podcast like this with a random sampling of guys from Gen X and talk about, you know, Silverhawks or Visionaries or, you know, Barnyard Commandos or Manglores or, you know, Crystar. Or those are all, like, by that point, kids had fragmented so much because Star Wars was gone. That was never going to come back around. I swear, He-Man, G.I. Joe, and Transformers, if any one of those had only existed on its own, it might have reunified all the kids. But because they all jumped out there off the success of Star Wars, it was all fragmented, and that collective experience is never coming back. In fact, the closest I would bet you could get generationally to that is talking to millennials about Ninja Turtles. I bet
that's pretty good. Yeah,
I could see that.
Yeah. Because like Star Wars, it started at the late part of a decade and dominated in the next decade. So it, Ninja Turtles landed in like the very end of 87 and dominated the first half of the 90s. And Star Wars was 77 and dominated the first half of the 80s.
Or like Power Rangers. I could see that.
Yeah, I can see Power Rangers definitely, though it makes me sad. Like Ninja Turtles doesn't quite make me sad because Ninja Turtles had a cool indie comic first that nobody mm-hmm. really knew about except adults. So at least it has some credibility. Like it has some edgy cachet, mm-hmm. You know, whereas Power Rangers. Yeah, I know it's based off of a Japanese show, but it's so just. Have you ever tried to watch that show?
Oh, it's terrible. I can't stand it. But
yeah,
most millennials I know, when they wax about their childhoods, mm-hmm. they bring up, I see Power Rangers brought up all the time.
Yeah.
And Ninja Turtles. And it's, I'm of that age where I wasn't exactly into it at that point. I mean, I was in high school.
Right.
So.
Yes. Same here. Yeah. Right. Power Rangers does nothing for me. I recognize its impact, but I also recognize that Power Rangers quality as a show has nothing on Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi.
No.
Not at all. Which then makes you go, you know, they're like, don't gatekeep my fandom. And it's like, I'm not gatekeeping your fandom. But I am going to say that kids that grew up on Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi into adulthood may be able to argue that they can hold their head a little higher with some more dignity. Like, I don't know that for a fact. I'm being just sarcastic, but the toys were certainly better as well.
Sure.
Star Wars, Empire, and Jedi toys. By 1993, those Bandai Power Rangers toys, they're not pretty to look at. I mean, they are some chunky monkeys. I mean, they're ugly. And you know,
yeah, I mean, the five of us here were witness to a cultural event that was Star Wars mm-hmm. that I don't think will ever be recreated again.
As
people want to, mm-hmm. like the Marvel movies might be the closest thing I could think of that might even come close, but
right,
it changed not only the film landscape, but it changed the toy landscape forever.
Yeah. If you use the Kenner toy line as the benchmark for the original Star Wars era, then it goes from, you know, not using Kenner in 77, but they were already working on it. Mm. 77 to 85. So you've literally got like an 8-year period. And while I was on the back half of that 8-year period, you know, I can still say, yeah, I walked into drugstores and there was Star Wars shampoo on a display in all the different character bottles. I mm-hmm. had a Luke Skywalker Oral-B toothbrush. You know, I was there with the read-along cassettes. I had my Luke Skywalker underoos. And so, like, we are part of this collective experience. And so to Tom's point, you know, he says, you know, Star Wars was the only toy line I was ever into. Well, there's little wonder, because every toy line I tried after, because I was a few years younger than Tom, Star Wars ended while I was, you know, plugged in. And I tried everything else and none of it measured up. None of it.
Right.
Yeah. So
we were all lucky to be at the perfect age for Star Wars.
Yeah.
The trilogy, the original trilogy. Original. Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. For sure.
I mean,
You know, now that I think about it, you can't fault folks that are younger because they've grown up with everything in their face. Everything is over the top. Everything is amazing. Everything has incredible special effects. It doesn't mean anything anymore. It's not interesting anymore.
No, that's the whole thing. I've never blamed somebody for when they were born. That they can't help that. I can blame them for bad taste, though. And I can point to things that are new that are really, really good. And I can point to things that are new that are really, really bad. And I can also fault a person of any age for being unwilling to try something that's older than them simply because it's older. I can always fault a person for that, because it's like, you know what? If you're not willing to look backwards, like you're willing to look forwards for your entertainment, then you are being self-prejudicial towards your own experience. In other words, I can't have a conversation with that person and take some of their holistic opinion seriously, because if they're going to make blanket statements about how Star Wars is the greatest thing ever, but I know they've not watched anything prior to 1977 to measure up against, then they're missing out on half or over half of our entertainment legacy. And so I sit back and go, yeah, but you know, the Thor thing, I'm like, really? Do you really think it's the best thing ever?
I mean, because I've talked to Star Wars fans, for example, that they love the Disney films, but they rag on the original trilogy. Oh, the special.
How old are these people?
I would.
Is it range?
They're not Gen X. They're like older millennials into Zoomers.
Hmm. I think those people are just trying to be interesting.
Yes. Good point.
It's
edgy.
Right. Oh, I'm right there with you, Tom, because it's like, oh, the special effects in the original Star Wars are terrible compared to the new one. I'm like, but you wouldn't have the new one without the original. Mm-hmm. This is what created it all.
Right. Right. It's like saying, and I've heard people say this before many times. It's even my buddy, Tim, or maybe not Tim. Few people have said it to me, and it's hard to remember who, because I have so many conversations on the internet. Most of them descend into arguments, but you know, they're like, I like the Daniel Craig Bond films, but I can't watch any of the old Bond films. Really? Oh yeah, they're just boring to me. They're just cheesy and boring. I'm like, Sean Connery is cheesy and boring. What planet are you from, and can you go back there? Like it. It's very weird to hear people say stuff like that. You know, right now I'm immersed in this research project, you know, all about this whole legacy of Robin Hood in film and media. And, you know, I was talking to my friend Scott the other day, and he didn't say anything bad, but, you know, I sent him some footage from the 1938 Robin Hood movie with Errol Flynn. And he came back and he was like, wow, he was like, I totally forgot and didn't realize what great dialogue was in those movies and how cool an actor he was. And, you know, I said, yeah, I said, all people think is, oh, cheesy green tights and whatever. And it's like, have you watched the movie? Like, have you actually sat down and paid attention and watched the story? Like, it's actually still a really good movie that holds up. And he's a really charismatic actor who holds the screen, and it's got great action in it. It's just, because it wasn't made when you were born, suddenly it's not relevant. And that's the same attitude I'm sure some of these people have with the old Star Wars movies. But I've talked to kids like my own second cousins. My cousin Jake was 9 years old when Phantom Menace came out. He was literally Jake Lloyd's age. Like he was, you know, and so he thought that those prequels at the time were just, that was his Star Wars. But just a year or two ago, he messaged me on Facebook going out of the blue. He was like, man, my friends, he's like, they're crazy. And I went, what are you talking about, Jake? He goes, they don't see how stupid and bad those prequel movies are. And he's like, the original trilogy is the only thing that's any good. And keep in mind, I haven't seen my cousin or my second cousin in over a decade. We're in separate states. We don't get to see each other that much. So I haven't been a constant influence on him.
Right.
But he is of that generation. He is a millennial beginning to end with all the foibles that come with that generation. And yet he's like, the prequels don't hold up. They're bad. And I'm like, it's like when our generation tries to sit back and revisit Flight of the Navigator. That movie is dog shit. All right. That movie is terrible. And yet, you know, it's from our generation. And it's like, no, it doesn't hold up. You know,
right?
Those films won't hold up, and these sequel films won't hold up either. Mark my words, they won't.
Yeah,
I'm being insolent. I know.
At this stage, do you think can it be salvaged?
What's done is done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So stick a fork in it. It's pretty much done.
After they started doing all of the shady firings of people, and then they canceled the shows those people were supposed to be in, and then they been shuffling things around, and they've been like, and then trying to cherry pick the good stuff out of the stuff they initially threw away and bringing it back in their own context. The whole thing's a mess. Star Wars Rebels was a terrible show. Star Wars Resistance was a terrible show. Bad Batch is just going to be Clone Wars 3.0. I don't really have any true interest in watching it, but Tim is making me just for content for our channel. Yeah, I'm like Tom. I think what's done is done. And I think I'm seeing a lot of Botox on Star Wars at this point, a lot of attempts to make it look like it was before it got, you know, kicked into the dirt. And I don't know.
So what about these sayings, for example, like, especially if you go online in different groups and whatnot, you'll hear about the toxic fan base or I don't know.
Toxic fan base is shorthand for anybody that didn't like the new films.
Right.
A thing.
I have friends that have said to me, since I don't like the new films, oh, I'm not a fan. Because yeah, I don't like the new
films. I've had people say that to me too. I've had people say that to me too. A lot. And my response is always like, that's gatekeeping in its own way. It's like, you can't be a Star Wars fan if you don't like all the things. I thought you didn't like gatekeepers. I'm not gatekeeping you from liking whatever you like. I'm sitting back going, you can be whatever you want. It doesn't mean I have to believe you have taste. I can believe you have bad taste. That doesn't mean I'm gatekeeping you from the fandom. It does mean I'm side-eyeing you as kind of a goofus. You know, like, yeah, I'm like Tom said, it's what's done is done. And the toxic fandom is not toxic fandom. It's people that just don't like these new directions that the story is taking. And the moment I argue that they cracked the entire foundation when they killed Han Solo in Force Awakens.
Mm-hmm.
And then they destroyed the entire facility. They blew up the entire neighborhood when they killed Luke in the next film. The moment they did those two things, and I told Melinda after we saw Force Awakens, we walked out of that movie on opening weekend, which she dragged me to because she felt like we needed to know what was in it because we ran this YouTube channel. And I said, I mark my words. I said, this is going to be a series of snuff films. I said, they killed Han in this one. I said, they're going to kill Luke in the next one, and they're going to kill Leia in the next one. I did say that to Melinda. She can back me up on that. And sure enough, it was kill Han, kill Luke, kill Leia. Because these...
Well, they of course, they wanted to clear the field for the new, you know, the new bright and shinies.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
My question then is, why didn't they just blow all three of them up in a McDonald's on Coruscant in the very beginning of the movie? Why didn't they just have them literally walk in like digital characters and you see them from a distance and then whammo, and the golden arches goes up and then they're like, oh my gosh, the heroes of the rebellion were in that McDonald's, you know, and then it just start, you know. You know what I mean?
The
like they
problem is anything that they create now, anything that's filled and oozing with fan service is not going to help. It's not going to help. Mandalorian, I think is great and fun, but yeah, it's not helping the franchise because we're already 6 feet deep. It doesn't matter at this point.
Yeah, yeah. I don't have any.
I'm not trying to be a curmudgeon like Michael. I think we're both curmudgeons.
We are. I'm like you, man. I don't have any hatred for Mandalorian. What I'm saying, like you, is that it represents something that's a non-starter. It's not going to resuscitate Star Wars in the way people think.
If they would have put the Mandalorian in the front before any of these movies, that this was the first thing that Disney did, that would have set the tone.
Right.
The thing is, we were force-fed spoonfuls of horse shit, mm-hmm, until we got to something that was actually halfway decent.
Right.
That's the problem. That's the folly of Disney, because the thing is, Disney wanted to... they wanted to clear the field because they felt that everybody was going to dig the, you know, the heavy-handed SJW-ness of this new horse shit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the Mandalorian feels like a Band-Aid. It feels like an attempt to right the ship and bring the fans back after they fumbled with those horrible sequels and Solo.
We've already hit that iceberg. It's too late.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead, Art. What were you saying?
Stuff was all going to be bad because Weird Al didn't make any songs about it.
Yeah, that was our first hint.
Yep. Right.
That was foreshadowing.
I mean, but you bring it up. I mean, let's face it, the Disney's gone woke. There's no other way to put it. Like my son, for example, my son's 11. He'll be 12 in January. When he was little, I introduced him to Star Wars because I wanted him to experience what I saw at his age. And he has absolutely zero interest in it at all. It's kind of sad, I feel. I mean, is it?
Well, the thing is, he's of a different era. I mean, he's had virtual reality. He's had special effects his whole life. So when you see Star Wars, it's you know, my dad could have showed me, you know, it's a bad analogy. War story footage, you know, these news articles from the war era. You know, people just don't relate to that. And young folks don't relate to old special effects and an old story. And what's that?
News on the march.
Yes.
But then again, my
Nazis are moving into France.
my son's weird. He would actually rather watch something like that or a documentary on the history of the Thompson submachine gun than he would Star Wars. But my son's odd like that. So
I can understand it's a tough sell to a new a kid who's grown up with spectacle. You know, when we were kids, there wasn't a whole lot of spectacle. Like I said, you know, we had the Shaggy DA and reruns of Bonanza on TV. So when you see Star Wars, that stuff is the shit. But when you're a kid nowadays, you've got incredible video games that are practically reality. Like looking out a window, everything is. Everything that isn't incredibly polished isn't really worth your time.
Yeah. Yeah. They do take it for granted as a generation that things are just supposed to look that way. And again, you know, that's not their fault. You know, they can't help when they were born, like Tom said earlier. It also does mean that Star Wars and things like it are not something that our generation as parents is going to be able to sell to them. But again, I've told some people this before. They've asked me, how can I get my kid into Transformers? How can I get my kid into G.I. Joe? Cause it's what I like. And I always look at them and I say, all right, did your parents like try to force you into the things they were into when they were kids? Like my dad never tried to sell me on Howdy Doody and the Lone Ranger. he never sat me down and was like, we're going to get into this. This is what you're going to be into.
That's a very good point. Yeah. You're going to like Star Wars or you ain't going out.
Yeah. But it's weird because our generation has been doing that systematically. They name their kids like Luke and Leia and stuff like that. And no knocking it. What I'm saying is that's how ingrained it is that predatory marketing has been ingrained into our generation. Collect them all. And it's like, now I've got to get my kids into this thing because I have now infused my identity with this thing. It's like, people can't figure out where their identity ends and their interests begin in our generation. And it's kind of dangerous.
How many times have you heard the question online? You know, my kid is 5 years old and what order of Star Wars should he yes. start watching Star yeah. Wars? It's yeah. like, what if your kid watches it the first movie you choose and he doesn't want to watch it anymore?
Uh-huh.
Then what?
Yeah.
That was my son. I introduced him to Star Wars. He watched the first one. He's like, okay, this is kind of cool. And then walked away. He had no interest in it
right.
at all. So
it's a tough sell.
Neither of my daughters had any interest in it either. Well, my youngest did for like a minute and that was it.
Yeah. And why should they? I mean, we weren't forced to be into our parents' stuff. We got to choose. And that's what I told this one guy. I was like, let them just choose what they want to be into. Cause that was the privilege you had as a kid. And he was like, I never thought of it that way. And I'm like, because our generation's been indoctrinated to believe that all the stuff we were marketed, that was marketed to us, is the be all end all of everything. And so we're still, we're like Rambo. We're trying to shake our programming and we tweak out as adults and we're like, you know, and we can't figure out why we can't, you know, divest ourselves of this stuff. It's interesting. So yeah, I think kids should just be allowed to be into what they're into as long as it's not illegal. That's just going to be the way it is. Some things will never change. That's just right. The way it is. So,
well, since we were a minute ago, we were discussing collecting and whatnot. I figured we'll bring up the elephant in the room.
I thought the elephant was already in the room.
Well, okay. The smaller elephant in the room. Let's put it this way.
Uh-oh.
I feel that at least the Star Wars collecting community, I mean, Art and Russ have discussed this, but they've become, for lack of a better word, toxic. They're bullies to each other. I mean,
yes.
I know I don't have a problem with reproduction stuff. I mean, guys like Stan Solo, they do beautiful stuff. Now, what do you guys feel? I mean,
like, I am the type of person who has always been very open about the fact that while Star Wars is so important to me as a vintage collectible and always has been, and my, as I've described in the show already, my inability to be in it long enough because I picked it up on the back 4 years of it, my inability to then gather up all the stuff I wanted meant that, and then of course a lot of lost weapons meant that Star Wars was sacrosanct to me as a toy line. I don't mean that in the sense that I wanted it sacrosanct for everybody else. I mean, it was sacrosanct for me. And so through the 80s and into the 90s, I was buying them off my friends. I was going to flea markets and garage sales, collecting as many of them as I could to try and fill the gaps. And I was also looking for at comic shops and everything else, the real weapons, because I remember losing those real weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So my personal collecting journey with vintage was, I have all vintage accessories with all vintage figures, and I have my, you know, original childhood vehicles and stuff like that, and I have dupes of a lot of them, but everything that's from that 96 to 97 figure run or 103 or whatever it is, anything that's in that run, all the stuff that's made out of plastic has to be Kenner plastic for me, like that, because of the reverence that I really do have for it, you know. That Death Star swing rope has got to be the real deal. And it is, you know, I bought the real deal. However, because I didn't get out of toys and then jump back in with a 10-year gap. You know, I didn't suddenly get nostalgic in my 40s after seeing J.J. Abrams movie and go, oh man, I wish I had my toys again. And then I flood the market and drive the prices up. Johnny come lately. Because I wasn't that guy, I've been looking at the Tomarts action figure guides and the toy fairs for decades. You know, I was buying those magazines monthly and stuff. So I've seen all the advertisements since the 90s for reproduction weapons, reproduction capes and accessories, all that stuff. So it's not new to me. So when I see like all these arguments now about orthodoxy of collecting and no repro and I'm sitting back going, you guys kind of sound crazy. Like it's nice to have options. We need options, because options are going to keep the prices from being astronomically, unrealistically high. And they're already at that point anyway, even with reproductions on the market. So all these people that I've seen who are always talking about value and talking about getting screwed over and talking about this and that. And it's like, okay, I'll just say this. And Tom has some inside baseball on this. I won't go into all the details, but I'll just give you an example. One of the most reproduced items that people are trying to point to as this could create fraud, people are going to get screwed over on this, is the vinyl cape for the Jawa. It's one of the most valuable variations of the figures. Russ knows this very well because Russ has one in his collection. Yeah, and especially now, I didn't have a vinyl cape Jawa until, wait for it, yesterday. And the thing is that even though we are now in a world where many, many, many repros exist and are sold by the thousands, you know, for that, on Jawas, on vintage Jawas, day in, day out, I've done my homework for 30 years. I know how to collect this stuff. all, and it's not because I bought somebody's expensive book, you know, or I watched somebody's documentary. I just keep up with it because I'm invested as a hobbyist. It's my passion. It's what I like. And so I knew, you know, who to talk to, who to get things verified. I was patient. I didn't just jump on the first thing that was expensive on eBay, because that's how you get screwed. Let things go if you can't get your answers. Another one will always come along. And sure enough, one came along. And the first thing I did was I had people that were experts that I trusted look at it in person for me. And then they were like, good to go. And then I acquired it. So I didn't have some horrible story about, oh my God, my vinyl Cape Jaw was repro. I'm going to go jump off a bridge and I'm going to take the guy that sold the repro with me. I'm going to pull a lethal weapon and handcuff him to my wrist and we're going to go together. Like it's so stupid. Like I know I sound like a petulant child talking about this, but I get that bad things happen all the time. You know, people get hosed, people get screwed, but most of the time people who get screwed, their excitement combined with their lack of knowledge and experience overrides their survival instincts. It overrides their self-preservation reflexes.
There's no one that should be in a position to get screwed over repros.
Yes.
Especially carded repros. You've got to be a complete fool to fall for a repro card. There are so many tells.
Yep.
And the thing is, the education to gain knowledge has been out there for at least 20 years. If you get screwed buying a repro card, then that's on you. That's not on anyone other than yourself. You know, Gus Lopez's website, I forgot what it is.
Star Wars Collector Archive.
The Collector's Archive. Come on, I mean, go there. That should be your first place to learn about these toys. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is reference, there is education, there are people who know this stuff. And if you're going to allow yourself to get screwed, then that's not my problem, that's yours.
Yeah.
And I think I'm going to add to what Michael said as well, as far as repro goes. The folks that are the most vocal about anti-repro are the folks that are making a profit.
Yep.
They have the most to lose. The folks that are making money off this stuff, selling vintage, they are the most to lose at this. And they obviously are the ones that are screaming the loudest.
Yep. Yep. It's shocking to me that one of the best websites, and I will say one of the best websites for educating yourself on how to identify repro weapons and accessories of any kind, is run by a person who doesn't preach education as the first line of defense and only line of defense. He wants what all these other crazy people want. He wants the entire Star Wars vintage market to be like a romper room safe space for every buyer out there, so nobody has to learn anything. And it's like, well, then, dude, why did you bother building the website? You built this excellent resource so that nobody could ever get screwed over ever again. And it actually works. Like I've followed that website for over 15 years now. It actually works. But yet education is not your MO. Your MO is control, control, control everybody else's behavior. Limit options. Don't do this. It's like, it's totally counterintuitive to all the effort that these people have put into these educational sites. It blows the mind. It really does.
That's a very good point.
Yeah. Tom is right. You can never get screwed over if you're doing your homework. And the information is literally right there.
Right?
No. I mean, most of this stuff, you can look at this stuff and in 1 second I can go, that's not real.
Right.
That's a fake. That's an obvious fake. And how can you not see that it's not a fake?
Mm-hmm. Especially final capes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, fortunately, thank God that the most reproduced card back is the 12 back, and that obviously is the most easiest to identify as fake. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yeah, so those vinyl capes, you know, like, yeah, I took my time to go through, you know, trusted experts who were willing to help me out because they knew what an investment it was, and and they were able to physically in person verify the item and look for the honeycomb, the very, very fine honeycomb pattern on the inside of the cape, and do all the stuff that all of us who are educated on this know how to do it. And or not honeycomb pattern, but texturing, the texturing on the inside of the cape. I've heard honeycomb pattern with the glue for so long that then I transpose it to vinyl. That's not what I mean, though. But the point is that if you're patient and you don't just have money to burn a hole in your pocket, you're very rarely going to get screwed. Very rarely. I've gotten a few reproduction weapons with a few purchases a few years ago when I bought the last 17. I was buying them up off Rebel Scum classifieds. But those guys were already in an anti-repro mode. And so when I told the seller, I was like, hey, this Beretta and this, the Beretta came with a fake weapon. It was the Stormtrooper Luke was just, I didn't feel like he was in a condition that warranted the price, but he was otherwise fine. But the Beretta was like, this staff is fake. It's clinky. It's fake. And the guy was like, oh my God, I'm really, really, really sorry. And I'm like, look, man, the figure's as described, you know, like it's really, really nice. I'm like, I'm happy to keep it. I'm like, but I'd just really love a discount on this. And, you know, he took $40 off the price of it because he knew that this was back in 2014. So he knew, you know, that staff went for about, you know, $25 to $30 then, but he took $40 off of it. And I walked away whole, you know, it was all right. People who get screwed over and fall into these situations, like that guy that claimed just a few months ago that he ended up paying like $35,000 for a fake double telescoping lightsaber. And you're going, it's like, dude, those figures now, you should only be buying those the way that you buy rocket firing FETs. You should be in a lawyer's office signing contracts before you actually change hands with collectibles that expensive. You should.
Yeah. I wouldn't even play that game. That's a risk.
Yeah, exactly. I would not just buy those off eBay. And there are other lines that have those too. So for example, Old Bob and the Humanoid from Black Hole.
Right.
I would not buy those outside of a contractual exchange. Like, we're going to go to a lawyer's office where there's a witness and a notary, and I'm going to exchange the few $1,000 to get these, and they're verified, because people are already replicating the Humanoid and Old Bob as figures, because so many people want them for display. I don't begrudge them that. I'm just going to play it smart if I want the real thing.
Right. No, the collecting space as a whole, as far as Kenner goes, kind of Star Wars, do you guys look at it as a bubble? Like, because the prices keep going up and up and up. Do you think it's ever going to hit maximum and then burst? Or will it just continue to go up? Because at the moment, it's almost pricing me out of the market. I can't afford, like, I'll never have a double telescoping Luke. There's no way. I just can't afford it. So do you see it reaching a peak and then bursting, or reaching a peak and then going back down?
That peak is going to be reached when all the vintage collectors die.
Yeah. There's a lot of people too right now that are, they're very OCD collectors and they hoard figures. So like they, and accessories, like I've seen people that just have tackle boxes, you know, with the little pull trays full of blasters that they've just hoarded. You know, they sell beater figures that happen to still have the weapons and keep the weapons. And there are guys that have thousands of Stormtroopers or thousands of Boba Fetts. There's like too many Boba Fett focus collectors to count. And so that falsely inflates the price of these individual figures. I do get to a point where, while I, for my own personal gratification, am orthodox about my accessory collecting, and thankfully I've finished that out. I have all the accessories I'll ever want, and they're all legit. And I got them all well over 7 years ago. So I got in right before Force Awakens showed up, which then drove all the prices up. I do think it does get ludicrous to say, well, I'm going to pay $200 for this Princess Leia blaster because I have been told that it's legit Kenner. It's like that is literally a 3/4 inch long, very, very thin piece of blue-black plastic, and you're paying $200 for it. I can't get there. And I can't get there with, the double telescoping lightsaber prices either in that respect. I have the benefit of being able to justify some purchases because I make videos and then those videos recoup some money. So I'm making entertainment, edutainment for people, infotainment. But if I was just still a collector out there, just collecting for fun, I wouldn't be able to justify some of these prices now. That's why one of the biggest anti-repro people in the country just recently for his convention did a custom figure and tried to put a repro blaster with it as a convention exclusive. And his following almost, you know, told him to walk into the ocean. I mean, but it's because he finally, as Tom was saying, he's a dealer, he's a toy seller. He finally got to the point where he realizes, oh, most of my customer base now can only afford certain things. So now I'm going to start edging over. I bet you that's his whole thing. Well, the money's now in reproduction parts because we've driven up the price of everything else. But I got to keep working. I got to keep selling. Can you imagine having been one of the people that drove up the price over the last 15 years of all this stuff, of the stuff you sell, to the point that you've now only got like 10 customers left and they've all got all the stuff they want? So you've got nobody to sell to for the most part.
Business is gone at that point.
If you're in this battle, you better be fucking consistent.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Wow.
I've actually have started a second set of vintage Star Wars figures, usually what I call finds in the wild.
Uh-huh.
And I'm actually buying reproductions for them. I'm keeping all originals in my my first, mm-hmm. but it's also an educational thing. You know, you can tell right away on most of them. There are a few that make me cringe because it's like just a little mark would be nice. So then, mm-hmm. but the mentality of melting and burning and destroying all these reproductions, mm-hmm. I don't get that, because some of these figures that I'm finding at the Goodwill are they're beat up. They're sad. It's just fun to see the history. And if I toss a little modern vintage looking accessory just to make them look displayable.
Complete.
Yeah.
Somewhat.
And I also bought a reproduction vinyl cape Jawa just for education. Words don't come out quickly with me. But I can do side by side with my original. Mm-hmm. And the fake, and it's so obvious because this was like a $20 reproduction cape. I didn't get the Jawa with it,
right?
So I wanted to make sure I bought one of the best qualities that are out there, and you can still tell.
Yeah, and now you're better prepared than anybody to spot those fakes. You'll never be duped. I mean, you've got the reference right there. It is very difficult in this day and age to justify not having reproduction options for people, because a lot of people want to collect their Star Wars nostalgia from our generation now because of the sequel trilogy's focus on retro, even though it didn't do retro very well, but it did it well enough that people are like, I want the real retro. I don't want Disney retro. I want the real retro. And now there's like three times the number of people vying for a diminishing amount of surviving product. So yeah, the reproduction stuff, it's going to become the stuff people can't afford. And these guys better get in the game or get out of the game at that
point. So here's a good question for you, Michael. These retro collection figures, mm-hmm. right? If you were to take one of those retro collection figures and take the weapon off Han Solo and put it with a true vintage Han Solo figure, mm-hmm. isn't that kind of in and of itself, isn't that the same thing as retro weapons?
Oh, yeah. That is totally a repro weapon. It just happens to have been made by Hasbro.
And the
funniest part is that the vintage figure will hold that weapon, whereas the retro collection Han won't. Because he's not molded properly.
Exactly.
But those weapons are excellently made. And I think aside from the Leia blaster, which they added a little detail to, very, very little. If it's in a blurry eBay photo, you're not going to be able to tell. But I think the only reason they added some extra details to that was because these crazy people were raising Kane, because that's the most expensive accessory next to the vinyl cape, Jawa's cape, and the DT lightsabers. And so they're like, oh, we can't flood the market with these because people get mad at us.
Right.
It's lunacy.
Yeah.
This whole repro thing is really a slippery slope of craziness.
Yeah.
I never thought I'd see where repros were starting to, they would start to gain huge value for it, but wow.
Oh yeah.
I almost wonder if at some point some of these repros that were made in the 90s that are a little bit more off color, that they actually were being made with the thought of not being fooling people, if they're going to start having more value than the ones that are made currently that are made to try and,
Well, that's a perfect example, Russ, because that's the whole thing. It's like the hypocrisy where they sit there and justify Uze figures and Model Trem bootlegs from South America and stuff like that. They're like, well, these were made during the time the Kenner stuff was out. I'm like, yeah, but they're still knockoffs. They're still repros. They're still, well, but these are worth a lot of money. It's like, no, to you they are, because you're crazy. But like all of those weapons and things like that that you're talking about, I don't see any difference between those and the Uzes and the Model Trems and all that stuff. It's all part and parcel to the same thing. So to say that, you know, like they love to say that, well, these are worth vintage prices, and but these are garbage. And you know, you made the point a second ago about the melting. We learn every month more and more and more about, because these people are forensically OCD about the different factories and the different styles and variations that came out of the factories, the accessories, well, how they looked coming out of Taiwan versus how they looked coming out of Macau versus how they look coming out of China, whatever. We've learned so much that it's been pretty established that that melting frenzy that went on about, you know, 10 or 11 years ago that still kind of goes on today, vintage accessories got melted in that fervor because they didn't know that they were actually looking at legit accessories from other regions. And so things got melted by people who were like, I saw the posts on the message boards back then. It was like, hey, so-and-so, I just melted my first repro accessory today and it felt great. And it's like, you look back on that stuff and you're like, how many legit accessories got wasted because people got caught up in this crusade? It's such a dumb thing to get, you know, God wills it. You know, it's like, why? Like these are action figure guns. It's silly.
Well, it's like that jackass. I can't think of his name. He filled an aquarium.
Red Letter Media.
Yes. What? Why would you do that? I mean, there's a finite amount of vintage figures in the world. Why would you just destroy them for? I don't get it.
Consider this. Let me chime in here real quick. Let's consider this. There were billions of action figures made. There were billions of Star Wars action figures made. This is not going to make a dent in anything. There were figures when I was a kid. There were figures to the ceiling in every bloody department store that I ever went to. There is no shortage of Star Wars figures.
Another thing.
So when I think he's doing it just to, you know, sensationalism and hey, look at me. But you know, when I see that, some people do get a little emotional, but it's like, yeah, that's just plastic.
Well, I looked at it. Oh,
I wouldn't do the same to my figures, but you know, to each their own. I mean, if he owns them, he can do whatever the bloody hell he wants to. It's just it was just a kind of
a publicity stunt.
Yeah, definitely.
Got him publicity for sure.
You can look and see that he had none of the last 17 or any really nice condition Luke Tech 20s.
These were beyond beaters.
They were beaters, and they were common Jedi figures mostly. You know,
naked
squid heads. So,
Many Weequays died that day. But that's the whole thing about it, is that he also, and again, I don't like the wanton destruction of it, but he wasn't sitting there trying to melt things because he thought they were fake. He was just trolling the entire idea of holding on to your nostalgia like a man child. Like he, and I'm not even saying that that was the right way to express it. I don't agree with what he did in the video, but I know what he was trying to do. It's a totally different thing than being a total like tweaked out zealot that's just like, I know this is a repro. I'm gonna get out my wife's skillet. I'm gonna burn it. Like I'm gonna melt it. No, it's gonna feel so good. It's gonna feel so good. And you're like, you've literally got guys on forums who I have the screenshot saying it. One guy was like, it still gives me a boner to think about melting that repro Jawa blaster. So I'm saying that like there's a mentality here where they think they're doing good, that I'm doing the Lord's work. And it's like, no, you're not. You're just wrecking stuff. And in some
it's cases, it's a weird kind of cultish like elitism that is so niche in a niche hobby that it's almost completely, well, it's not almost, it's completely laughable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the thing is, everyone else, if you were to explain this nonsense to anybody that was outside the hobby, they would look at you like you just ate your own feces.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do. I've talked to people outside of the hobby about it.
Yeah, it's people look at you and go, you need to see someone now.
Yeah. It would be like if there was a big Three Stooges fan club. Like, I know there is one. But this is a hypothetical one. If there was a big, big, big Three Stooges fan club, and there was this one group of like 20 people in the fan club who were always screaming and yelling that all the episodes with Curly Joe aren't real Three Stooges. And you're going, when are they going to shut up about Curly Joe and just watch the shit? Like, when, you know, like that's what you deal with when you deal with that group of people. It's weird. It really is.
Wow.
The Star Wars hobby itself is just pretty bonkers anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We're all really, I think we're all kind of insane.
Yeah, the trick is focusing your insanity on something productive.
That's yeah.
It. Yeah.
Well, all I know is last year I went out to see Art and I picked up a Imperial shuttle that had been missing from my collection since about 93. And it's complete and sitting on my shelf, so I'm happy. I mean, if it makes you happy, do it, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's why we're all here, of course. Mm-hmm.
I like to just hate on things according to the internet.
Oh.
So apparently hate drives me. So I guess I'm not certain. I thought I did things for the joy, but you know, after somebody tells you long enough that you're, you know, just a perennial grump, I'm starting to believe it.
Let the hate flow through you.
So, gentlemen, what for our final thoughts, where do we want to go here? How do we want to put a bow on this?
Disney stinks.
Well, their mascot is a rat. So, I mean...
I it all depends. Is it a repro bow? Because no. Final thoughts. Tom, you got any?
Yeah. I think it's, let's just take the good with the bad. We still have Star Wars. We still have ways of watching the originals as you know, before Lucas decided to alter them. And hey, if you don't like the original trilogy, that's fine. If you like the prequels, that's fine. If you love the Disney stuff, that's fine. Like I said before, we're all standing in line at a buffet and you can pick the Salisbury steak if you like it. You can leave the fried chicken if you want. You know, before, like McDonald's in the 70s, it tasted better back then.
Yeah, because he's lard.
Yeah, but now it's at this point, I'm getting too old to be mad at people who like the sequels. I'll just be over here with my Topps trading cards and you know, I'll be good.
I'm very much in the same vein. People mistake me as somebody that's mad at people who like The Thing. And I'm like, no, I'm mad at people who are mad at me for not liking The Thing. And fandom for Star Wars is now very generational. You know, Star Wars originally was a generational phenomenon for Gen X. Well, now Star Wars is something that's multi-generational, and each generation has its entry point, and then people fracture. Like, for example, my cousin's entry point was Phantom Menace as a 9-year-old, but now he recognizes that the original trilogy is the best, even though his friends don't. So everybody's going to start pepper shaking into a different spot in where their opinions fall. What I've learned in my journey through the whole Star Wars experience from 1982 for me all the way to the present is that it's taught me how to emotionally divorce myself from using a franchise of the film industry as a way to establish an identity. I've come to the realization, not suddenly, but it was around 2002 with Attack of the Clones being so terrible, that it made me realize, yeah, my identity is not because I'm a Star Wars fan and watch all this stuff and read all these books. My identity is something completely different, which was a valuable learning for me. That was, you know, and so Star Wars is this thing that was very important in my life at the right time. And I'm glad that I lived in the time when Star Wars was a new thing and it was, you know, changing the world in a positive way for kids. And it occupies a place on my shelf now in a perspective that I didn't have 20 years ago. 20 years ago, my perspective was it's the be all end all and nothing's better than it. And now my perspective is those three movies hold a sacred place next to Lawrence of Arabia, next to The Adventures of Robin Hood, next to The Great Escape, next to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, next to all these films that I really revere. And it happens to be, you know, a collective three as one. It happens to be one of them, the Star Wars trilogy. So, yeah, it's I'm long-winding this answer, but it's still here, like Tom said, and it's going to mean something different to different people. But to those that make it part of their personality, I hope and pray for them, because one day that will blow up in their face existentially and they'll have to reconcile that.
I kind of think we were our generation, or our age groups, were kind of blessed and damned at the same time. Mm-hmm. Because we watched stuff like Star Wars, Star Trek, Ghostbusters. We were alive when it was great.
Yep.
But the unfortunate thing is that we're watching the death of franchises. Mm-hmm. We have to watch the birth, the life, the good times, the bad times, and then the ultimate death of every franchise that we ever loved growing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they're
not just fading away like the Lone Ranger did. They're actually dying in front of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they're essentially being killed.
Killed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was kind of one of the things. Like, I actually saw, what was it, The Force Awakens in the theater. I wanted to see the Falcon fly on a big screen one more time. And I was so disappointed because I should have read the book first. Otherwise, right. I wouldn't have bothered. But, you know, when they killed off Han, that was like watching Kirk die all over again in the first Next Generation film, Generations.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're watching all of our heroes get killed off.
Yeah.
You know, and it'll be Indy next.
Well, that's the big folly of all this, is I have no problem with them introducing new characters that represent the new generation and the new demographics and the new everything like that. But doubling down on that by killing the old characters pointlessly only incenses and enrages and incites, you know, that level of, we really are wanting you gone. And it's like, but you don't have to. You could actually create a bigger fan base by keeping us there and bringing new people in. I got no problem with new characters. Just don't kill off the old ones. There's no point to do that except to make me mad.
problem with Disney is they don't know what they have, and they don't know what to do with it. But here's the kicker: they don't care.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
One thing you don't want to talk about nowadays is, you know, you were always said, you were always told never talk religion and politics. Add Star Wars to that now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, just imagine if Disney were to actually give a shit about what it is they had. They actually bring in people that actually care about it. How much bigger could it be? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree.
So, anything else to add, gentlemen?
No, I'm good.
Michael, Tom, thank you very much for coming on the show. It meant a lot to us. If you'd be willing, you always have an open invitation to come on.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
So, I think this is the only time that Michael and I actually get together is when we join podcasts and wax poetic.
That's true. But Tom, I've been very sensitive toward you've been in the middle of this big move because I've been wanting you to come on some retroblasting live streams and stuff. I haven't asked though, because I know I've seen all the photos of you packing up stuff and everything like that. I'm like, well, I'll wait until he says he's settled and then we'll start doing that. So
yeah.
Well, you better hit me up quick, because the thing is, the older I get, the lazier I get. So
really, that's a very, very stark admission. I appreciate the candor. I really do. Okay. I'll keep that in mind.
And listen, Tom, thank you very much for, I in the middle of the move. Thank you very much for coming on. We're so appreciative of it.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
Sure.
Really awesome.
Thank you. It's fun chatting with both of you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it was a pleasure for me. I always love talking Star Wars with folks who have a like mind and understand the do's and don'ts ins and outs. And I don't know. Nowadays it just seems like Star Wars is kind of a negative thing, which is kind of a downer, but it is what it is.
I know.
We can't take back what's happened. So it's now part of the history of Star Wars.
I've actually backed away from so much Star Wars online. I mean, I was just trying to separate myself and getting back to real life and losing the negativity that just was flooding my newsfeed always. So that's kind of where Star Wars has ended for me right now, is I'm just going back into my Rusquatch cave and playing with my toys by myself.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, there's good in everything. And if you find the joy flying solo, as it were, it's probably a better place than hopping on the internet and getting frustrated.
Yeah.
And on that, thank you, everyone. And we will catch you on the next one.